The other thing to keep in mind, and this is technical, I know, but it's important for your listeners to understand that these supposedly bad things that have happened with the cost of capital, i.e. the interest rates have gone up from zero interest rates for 10 plus years to what it is today very, very quickly, that's had a very good impact on funding levels for defined benefits because their liabilities are linked to those rates. And therefore, they've all become suddenly very well funded. And what happens when they're very well funded is they take risk off the table, because why wouldn't you? You needed £100. You've now got £140. You don't need to be in the markets anymore. You end up buying very, very long-dated government paper in the currency that you have to do your disbursements in, then you're out of the market. Those are not schemes that are good to think about sustainable investment.
Welcome to Sustainability Wired, the show that plugs into the thinking that moves sustainable finance. I'm Lorenzo Sa, I'm the Chief Sustainability Officer at Clarity AI, and I'm excited today to cover the topic of sustainable investment strategies, and specifically from the angle of those asset owners that don't invest their money directly, but call them indirect asset owner if you like, and they're basically going through investment managers to actually make sure that someone is investing and allocating their capital. Now, from that perspective, why are we even taking this topic? There's been a lot of discussion. I just got back from PRI in person about the role of asset owners and how they can actually move on capital and actually drive the theory of change. But beyond stating that, I thought it was interesting to understand what does actually that mean. So how do asset owners define their strategy, and then how does that become a strategic asset allocation? And therefore, how does that convert in a choice of specific themes, specific asset classes, and ultimately then what happens in the choice of selecting an investment manager? So from that perspective, we wanted to bring someone on board that could combine and talk to us about both their expertise in sustainable investments, but also that spent time with a lot of asset owners, not just one, both their operational people as well as their trustees. And so with that background, I'm delighted today to have Anastasia Gua on the show. She's the Global Head of Sustainability and Impact Investment at Gallagher. Just recently in October, Gallagher acquired Redington, and within Redington and now in Gallagher, Anastasia does the investment consulting part of the business, which I think involves, and she'll tell us all about it, investment research, and this is for pension funds, wealth managers, and institutional investors. Anastasia, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Lorenzo.
Look, before we jump into the topic, I think the first thing we want to do is really get to know you and kind of get a sense of what your journey has been into sustainable investing and then more general into investment consulting. So tell us all about it.
Okay, really quick potted history is that I grew up in New Delhi, India, more or less, by and large, but I come from a very international family with close family members living on all continents. The family motto has always sort of been at home in the world. And I decided to come to England to do my master's degree. And when I did that, it was just pre the GFC, the global financial crisis, and all of my cohort were trying to get into the buy side or the sell side of the markets in London because I had a relatively economic focused degree. And I did the same thing and went into the sort of graduate analyst programs at one of the buy side firms and realized quite quickly that it was not for me because it required a level of seriousness and nerdiness that I just didn't feel I really had. I was much more of a dilettante, somebody who liked to know a lot of things about a lot of things, not lots of things about one thing. And I decided to go into financial journalism, which I did for a few years. And strangely enough, I'd never heard of this at this point. I was in my late 20s, never heard of sustainable investment. I think the year was 2010. I'd gone to Brussels to speak on a sort of conference where I met a chap called James Gifford. You know him and I know him. We both worked at the PRI. He was the founding executive director of the PRI. And he was talking about ESG investing at the time and universal ownership and these sorts of things. And I was like, wait, that seems to be surely where the future's headed. And we happened to be on the same flight back to London. So we had a bit of a chat and he said, yes, you should think about applying to us. And I did and started working there and then worked there for 10 years from 2011 and worked with you, Lorenzo, from 2011 right through 2021. And when I reflect back at that time, really was at the foothills of pretty much every movement we see today, good and bad, you know, from the pushing of asset owners to do more, to, you know, thinking about climate risk management through the TCFD process, through mandation and policies being the way to push asset owners who then push the market, etc. Saw all of that happening, participated in some of that, had hopes for what that would precipitate. And then, of course, you know, in 2021, really, the reason I left was because I'd spent 10 years from my late 20s to my late 30s in the same institution. I felt like I should probably go into the private markets and see what the real world was like. And here I am.
Amazing. And we want to know what that private market looks like. So thanks for sharing. And in a way, you work with asset owners and a recent OECD pension market and focus report talks about the global pension pot to be about 65 to 70 trillion of assets under management. Now, we know that some of those assets are now increasingly being managed by asset owners that are investing directly into the market. You know, think about the Canadians or the Australians that kind of often are doing that. But we also know that a lot of asset owners still significantly lean on the investment managers to make sure that they're actually taking on their assets and implementing their strategies into their daily activities. So that's, as I understand it, the work you're involved with, right? That's kind of like, okay, there's a strategy in place. How do we do strategic asset allocations? How do we make sure that what the asset owners want is delivered and that they can select asset managers that actually do that and that align to those overall strategies? So my question is, why would an asset owner want to even have a sustainable investment strategy in the first place?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and one that I would start by saying all asset owners, pensions or otherwise, are different from each other. They have commonalities when you look at the same types, but they fall away pretty quickly. So my clients are the entire gamut of the institutional investor marketplace, and that's really pension funds. That's about 60% of our current business. That includes defined contribution funds, defined benefit funds, and open-ended defined benefit funds, of which there are still a few left. And then the second part of the business, which is the faster growing part, is everyone else. So this is the wealth managers, the insurers, endowments and foundations, and actually other ultra long-term, like, you know, very high net worth individuals who go into multifamily offices specifically. And so when you look at that group, what do you typically start with? You start with, how much money do I want to make on an annual basis? And sometimes the question is, how much money do I want to make on an annual basis, if you're a family office, perhaps? But for most institutional investors, the question is, how much money do I need to make on an annual basis? And that need could be different. You know, we talk about liabilities, pension liabilities that they have to pay, literally pensioners who are depending on you to make that money, to disperse it to them because they're retired and they have that contract with you. That's only one type of liability. Frankly, endowments and foundations have their own because they are grant givers. So if you do not raise the capital that you need to raise on an annual or a, you know, five-yearly basis, the amount of grants that you give will go down. Everyone needs the money for something, is what I'm trying to say. So the first thing you do is you try to figure out how much money you actually need. And then what would you like to get to make that comfortable? So just like anyone else saving for anything, I need £100 return every year, but could I please have 110 just to make sure if anything goes wrong, that there is some sort of a buffer and to deal with any volatility that takes place in the markets, particularly as we speak. And depending on how much money you need, that's how much risk you have to take. Now, if I am a very underfunded pension fund, which means I don't actually have the money to disperse to my all the contracts I have with my members. Or if you are an endowment and foundation with a very high disbursement, you need to disperse 40 million over the next 3 years, and you are an endowment with only 200 million in your reserve, it's your corpus for investment. The risks you have to take change quite a lot compared to an insurer who almost needs to make nothing, just needs to keep the principal intact. So essentially needs to make inflation. So CPI. Now that changes things completely. That's the amount of risk that you want to take. And depending on the amount of risk you want to and have to take is how you choose your asset allocation. Because we know some assets give us higher returns because you're taking on more risk, equities, for instance, and others, if you're taking on less risk, will give you a more stable return, like developed market debt.
But okay, so that's a really good setting, but it's still then, where does the sustainable investing part come in? You know, and I imagine that now your answer might be different depending on the answer to that first question.
Yes. So in every instance, again, there's a lot of individuality. If you're looking at the UK, for instance, where I'm based, institutional investment, pensions market, that is over a certain size. So if you're 1 billion plus as a corporate plan in the UK, you have to do climate risk assessment through TCFD every year. So, hey, it's just mandated. And it's not just that. You also have to do an implementation statement, which is saying, how are you actually carrying out the plan? You have to do, which will include things like stewardship. So there's a lot of regulation in this market. That is not the case in other markets. In other markets, you bring in the sustainability as a risk tool or as a tool to deal with various stakeholders. To give you an example, we have clients in Northern Europe for whom there is no compliance in the same way as there is in the UK, yet they're actually very thoughtful in the way they do sustainability because there's a license to operate issue, which is unspoken. But underneath that, there's also a competition issue. You know, if you're an outlier with all of your peers doing something that you're not doing, you start to make a point by not doing it, and you may not want to make that point. So there's that. And can I also just take 1 second to say, endowments and foundations come from a very different place. They often want to be mission aligned because they are actually trying to solve the problems in the world through their grant giving in one way or the other, or they're attached to a university which inevitably has young people involved, and therefore there's a sustainability imperative there. And so everyone comes for different reasons. And there are some that don't do it at all.
And some don't do it, and those that do it for different reasons based on either geographical reasons or their own values, decisions of how they want to operate in the market, or they're stokeholders. All right, so now they've decided to move, they want to do this. How do they do it? So what does it look like, both from a theoretical perspective, what is the look at, and then can we look at examples?
Typically, I mean, I'll talk about myself. It's always easier just to make it real. I am the global head, as you said, of sustainable and impact investment. And what that means is my team and I advise our clients on what they should be doing about everything to do with sustainable investment strategy. That includes what they should be doing at a beliefs level or working with them on their beliefs level. And we talk about that in a second. Thinking about what their baseline is, so all of the analytics, et cetera, for their baseline, thinking about what their objectives are, you know, what's the goal. And then, of course, as you mentioned before, thinking about implementation, which is how do you achieve that goal through the markets, through fund managers, who should you pick, what asset classes, et cetera. And then finally, evaluating on a regular basis if your goals are being met, how are they being met, any trade-offs that you're making or not making, and what you want to reset as goals in future years. So that's my job. And so in many ways, what typically happens with investment consulting is the people who do investment consulting don't also do manager research. And my team, most of my team don't do manager research. It's just, you know, it's a very collegiate culture, and actually marrying the two is very helpful to my job. And so that's something that I have done personally in my role. So that therefore, I lead a lot of our impact work in our manager research alongside the asset class specialists. But the impact advice, for instance, about what you should be doing when you're looking at impact, et cetera, comes from me. So when I'm saying called in, it's, hang on a second, let's talk about the compliance clients. We now have to think about climate risk reporting. Where do we start? And by the way, how does it fit into our investment strategy? How does it fit into those expected and required returns? How does it fit into our liquidity, hedging, strategy, et cetera? And that's when I would come in.
So that's when you come in. So thanks for that clarification. So going back to the question, so you're called up to come in and looking at the sustainability side for these asset owners. How do you actually go about it?
Okay, so let's just take two separate examples. Let's take an example of a medium-sized endowment and foundation, and then let's also take a very, very large corporate DB pension scheme and do them separately. So let's start with the large corporate DB pension scheme. What would happen there is that we would have started with baseline work. So we would have taken all of their assets and we would have put them through data checks to see what their carbon, or all of the carbon metrics we all know, from carbon footprint to intensity to absolute emissions, et cetera, would have been. We then take that particular trustee, and that's another thing to understand, our primary clients on the other side of the desk is the chair of trustees or the chair of the investment committee and the trustees. We work very closely with in-house teams where there are in-house teams, but our allegiance, as it were, is often with the trustee groups. And what happens there is you take the trustee group who've often never thought about this, really. They've thought about it individually, perhaps, but not as a group. You do a belief session with them, but you give them their data because it's very difficult to do a belief session having absolutely no clue what your assets are currently doing. So we always used to, and you know, again, I'm saying used to because this market's moved on so much since, but we would give them their data. We would then run a belief session and we would get a sense of what's their persona. Do they want to be a progressive pragmatist? Do they want to be a leader? Do they want to be compliance plus? Who do they want to be in the space? And often that's the first time they've had that discussion, and flowing from that goal of who they want to be. Let's take the example of a client who wants to be, we work with a client who has always been, long before there was this compliance regime in the UK of climate risk analysis, wanted to be a leader and have been leaders, I mean real leaders, for a very long time, launching products, bringing strategies to their beneficiaries long before anyone else. They want to then essentially stay in that place, but they also want to be thoughtful about their risk management. So once they've decided that, we then start to think about, okay, those are our objectives. Now, how do we implement that? We know which asset classes we're in. How do we maximize our objectives in each asset class? And then you choose the managers, or you move managers, or you do all of those sorts of things. Typically, what happens is there's a lot of stewardship that has come in. So stewardship becomes much more robust because now you know what you're asking. It's not, hey, fund manager, what did you do with my assets this year? And you can just tell me in a one-way fashion. It's much more, here are my objectives. Here's what I'm trying to achieve. Tell me how you're going to help me achieve this and report back to me in a year, 2 years, 3 years.
Typically, I think many of us would think of stewardship as an investor speaking with the company. I think here what you're talking about is an actual trustee or asset owner speaking with the investment manager. How does that work? Is it the trustees? Is it you on their behalf? Is it together? Is it different depending on the size of the trustees?
So in practical terms, it's probably every mandate that the trustees have, and they can have a lot of mandates, but often they don't have hundreds and hundreds of mandates, will be sent the goals and the objectives so that they can respond to them, particularly those who have chosen themes to look at for their stewardship work, which is very often certainly climate change, but other things as well, that those are reported on an annual basis. It's always a combination of the trustees and the investment consultant that does that, because what we need to give the trustee is the right questions to ask.
You mentioned climate as a theme. More broadly, how do you look at themes in consulting to your asset owners, is there something that you look at from a theme perspective that you think is more successful from a sustainability perspective or not? Or again, is that as ad hoc? You know, we're going into a year, having seen what's happened this past year, we're going into a year that potentially could bring up new themes. How do you see this, and what is your approach to advising on this?
Consultants like to devolve power to fund managers. The whole point with all of the hundreds of hours of white savvy due diligence that consultants do to pick what they think are the absolute top class managers in every asset class is to give them the runway to do what they need to do to provide risk-adjusted returns. The idea that we would second guess them at a very granular level is probably not for us. I mean, that's certainly not the way we think as a house. You know, typically I would say, 10 years ago, we would say thematic investment is not particularly a good idea because by the time you love a theme, it's already overpriced or overbought. And by the time you're in it, it could be oversold, which means that, it starts to talk about themes like financial themes. I think today things are a little bit different because there are some meta narratives, and climate is clearly one of them, that are developing that clearly none of us can duck out of. And so the point is that you want to keep those themes as wide as possible. Now, I don't always succeed with this. And I was going to give you an example for the endowments and foundations. The endowments and foundations usually come with very baked in ideas about what they care about. And to be honest with you, the vast majority of them, it's not climate. It's everything else. Because that's how they disperse. It's health, it's education, it's inequality, it's decent jobs, it's D, E, and I. It's all of those other things, which frankly are much harder in many ways to be able to express through your investment strategy. So you'd really, as certainly from my perspective, you really see the whole gamut.
Okay, but so that's on the themes, and it's a great, I get it. What about the asset classes? I would imagine that you might be getting, and maybe I'm wrong, some indication of how the asset allocation needs to be done from an asset class perspective. And how does that triangulate, if it does, with the sustainability issues?
Yeah, it's a good question. Now, we have lots of different ways of cutting this, but the big distinction I want to make at this point is the difference between sustainability and impact. And the distinction I'm making here is sustainability is risk adjusting. There's some opportunity side to it as well, but that opportunity side is heavily to do with financial materiality. Impact is something different. Impact is trying to, and particularly non-philanthropic impact, is trying to catalyze investments into areas that you think are going to generate a positive societal return, at least at average, at least an equity-like return. So I think that asset classes are definitely, there are ups and downs. And, you've heard this, Lorenzo, this is something we love in our markets about primary capital versus secondary capital. What is more impactful? I mean, everyone that's not got a product in the market will probably have a sense of what's more impactful. But we have to understand that a lot of our clients cannot invest in primary markets, so cannot invest in private markets for all sorts of reasons. And those who can may also have some risk tolerance issues. So for instance, venture capital and small-scale opportunities are very popular in impact. The problem is if you're looking at it from an asset allocation perspective, to be able to diversify the risk of a binary loss, because that's what venture is, it's the power law, means that you have to have a certain number of those types of assets to make sure that they don't all sink you. So firstly, you're allocating only a small portion of your total sleeve, if you have an impact sleeve, for instance, into that. And then secondly, which actually works out well because they typically are very small opportunities anyway, but then the second thing you have to do is you have to diversify that. Now, the number is going to be different for different modeling firms, but you're looking at certainly between 5 and 10 opportunities of that size. Now, just think back to one of my primary concerns. The thing that always is a struggle for me is governance budget. Now, here I'm talking about how many times to the group of people who make decisions about this stuff, trustees, investment committees, other bodies of that type meet in a year? And how many other decisions do they need to make? Because making 7 decisions or 10 decisions for new managers in a year is pretty extraordinary. In larger schemes, you'll be making 1 or 2 in a year, perhaps not even that, depending on how stable your scheme is. And for smaller schemes, you know, as you can imagine, everything starts to become more tricky. So the whole governance starts to creak. So then you're thinking, okay, if I have to allocate to 7 or 8 impactful opportunities, I'm now going to have to do them over 2 years, maybe 3. And the reality of that starts to bite. Whereas when you're in the market, when you're not doing this kind of thing, you spend all your time thinking about, oh, what's impactful, and look at this backlash. Well, the real backlash is time.
So it's resource constraints that has an implication on how you can actually allocate to some of this.
Lorenzo, I would say it's much more than resource. It's time budget constraints. This is not about, okay, let's put in another 6 meetings to be able to get this through. Because the way that the governance of this whole thing works is that you have specific duties for every trustee. They can't just add in a bunch of meetings or increase the length of their meetings to change that. There's a reason they slow it down, because they don't want you to make extraordinary decisions. Because just like any other body, you don't want to put a lot of power, particularly of very long-term illiquid assets, into the hands of, you want that churn, you want the trustees to change a bit so you get another perspective, because all of that is risk management. If one particular group suddenly does 70 allocations, that would be a huge governance issue.
But I'm trying to read where you're going with this. It seems to be, is this that type of investment needs to come from somewhere else? Or is it will come, but it will take time?
It just means more people need to be doing it. At the moment, a very, very small sliver of the market, firstly, can make these sorts of investments, and secondly, want to make these sorts of investments. Let's think of defined contribution versus defined benefit. Defined benefit cannot make these kinds of, no matter where you are in the world, unless you're an open-ended scheme, which means, you know, the fact that your defined benefit is incidental, you just have to make a return, a high return forever, essentially. Those are, you know, those are unicorns. There are very few schemes like that in the world. But they should be treated as ultra long-term investors, just like the ones I was talking about. And actually, we've said this for years, time horizon is everything in this market. The problem is that for defined contribution schemes, which is where the majority of citizen savers' wealth is going globally, the structures are not built to be able to do this well yet. It's just really hard. And to try and make these structures work, people start taking risks that in black boxes that perhaps we're cautious about. And the second thing is that we have, on the other side, that the willingness is there, but the ticket sizes are small. And, you know, I just was talking to some clients who've made 2 very interesting, impactful decisions in exactly the end of the market we're talking about. It took them 1 year to do that.
So it's a call for more players to do this if we want to get the scale to move the needle on that type of investment. So the more the impact kind versus the sustainable investment side. That's clear. Look, maybe taking a step back and going back to something you looked at, and you kind of answered, but I'd like to go back to that, which is, how does your work change if you're advising on more asset liability matching versus absolute returns?
I think it's exactly what I mentioned before. That you know, I was talking the distinction between what you need versus what you want. Actually, there's no difference, because whether you are doing it for disbursements or you're doing it for actual liability matching, there is a certain return that you have to make. Now, for endowments and foundations, for some other types of investors, particularly for multifamily offices, there's more leeway. So if you sort of aren't able to meet your return requirements for 1 year or 2 years, you know, there might be some buffer there. But for pension schemes, that's quite slim. And what starts to happen, which we don't talk about enough in the sustainable investment industry, is that you have to start going back, if you are deeply underfunded, to the corporate sponsor to ask for money, which can obviously be a very tricky and difficult situation. The other thing to keep in mind, and this is technical, I know, but it's important for your listeners to understand that these sort of supposedly bad things that have happened with the cost of capital, i.e. that the interest rates have gone up very quickly around the world from zero interest rates for sort of 10 plus years to what it is today very, very quickly, that's had a very good impact on funding levels for defined benefits because their liabilities are linked to those rates. So the higher the rates go, the lower the liabilities. And therefore, they've all become suddenly very well funded. And what happens when they're very well funded is they take risk off the table because why wouldn't you? You needed £100 to do something. You've now got £140. You don't need to be in the markets anymore. So what you end up doing, you end up buying very, very long-dated government paper in the currency that you have to do your disbursements in, whether it's gilts in the UK or treasuries or whichever currency your liabilities are in. And then you're out of the market. Those are not schemes that are good to think about sustainable investment.
But I think we know that the world is moving from more this DB to a more DC pensions. In that evolution, which I think is right, but contradict me if not, but if that is the direction of travel, how will that impact sustainable investments?
To be honest with you, there are two different types of conversations. Sustainable investments, which is essentially getting the current economy that we have to do everything a little bit better, versus to build a new economy, to build new structures, to build new infrastructure, both for people as well as for planet, and to do it all with some amount of social equity. Those are two different things. DC can do sustainable investment just like DB ever could, and perhaps more so because they're often competitive. What I mean by that is, as a citizen saver, you can move from one DC scheme to another. And so you will see that that competition means that if the market happens to be the kind of market which takes sustainability seriously, for instance, the UK, for instance, Australia, then everyone's trying to do a little bit better than the others, offer a few more strategies outside of their defaults that sort of appeal to you. The problem is a question of structure. You know, globally, you've got this liquidity issue there, which means that you're often having to be marked to market. And, you know, I'm trying to buy a forest, or I'm trying to buy land and grow a brand new forest. It's going to take me 10 years to get a penny out of it. How am I supposed to put that into a mark-to-market DC structure? Now, people are trying to find ways, but it seems it's very early stages. And, you know, I suspect we're going to have to do lots of different iterations to get it right.
I mean, are we giving too much of a role to the asset owners in general? Like this example you just made of the forest. What is the way forward? Is it expecting that the asset owners drive this agenda, or it's more that they're part of it?
After having worked in this market for nearly 17 years, I would say, you know, the famous movie, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. I think we fixate too much on this solution versus that solution. We need all the solutions. We needed policy. We need asset owners to push more. We need investment managers to be more competitive with each other with the race to the top. We need people to all be more financially minded, thinking about materiality, because sustainability has to pay. Impact has to pay too. And I'm making the distinction between the two as I speak constantly. At the moment, the question, I say this all the time, does sustainability pay? Does it make us feel good, or does it actually pay us pounds and pence? And over what time period does it pay? And if we can answer those questions, then we can decide who wants to go into that bet. Because I think the problem has been that we have said we should, you know, when the movement started to become very big, when it became truly mainstream, it became a bit of a conflation of morals and financial returns. And I think what's happened now is that because of what's happened with cost of capital and what's happened with the macro news around, including new technology, et cetera, and the fact that over the last 5 years, many of our brightest stars have made poor returns in terms of fund managers who try to do things, by the way, both from a financial perspective as well as a sustainability perspective. It's not like they only failed in the finances. You know, we have funds that went in and bought specifically sort of middle-range value companies to be able to work closely with management schemes and really turn them around from a stewardship basis. Storied funds that now no longer exist in, you know, from 2025. So you've got a lot of a breakdown of what works. And I think what we're trying to come out of it is a rethinking of what might work. And by the way, one thing I would say is this is not just a sustainable investing thing. This is an investing thing more generally.
Maybe let's take an example of what's out there, which is the net zero alliances and the net zero initiatives. In that everything everywhere all at once, there's been a lot of stakeholders and a lot of net zero initiatives. There's been the investment managers, the insurers, the banks, the asset owners, et cetera. And a lot of these have actually either slowed down or collapsed. The asset owner is the only one that's kind of stuck to its ground as a net zero initiative. When you advise and work with your asset owners, what is the conversations you have with them around all the other initiatives? And do you see them as needing to encourage that? Or is that an irrelevant element in the market?
In the entire time that I've been working with asset owners, we have never once really discussed the initiatives, even though 40% of my clients have net zero targets. And it's because, as I said to you, I think we spend too much time when we're outside of these conversations thinking about homogenization, because it's easier to understand as a construct. Nothing is homogenous. And so the question is not what's happening to the initiatives, but what's happening to your fund? What's happening to your net zero targets, not what others are doing to theirs, particularly those outside of your industry even. I think the asset owners that I work with are very cognizant of this net zero idea. Firstly, I hope all of them would say to you, Lorenzo, if you were having this conversation, Lorenzo, it's not just net zero, it's net zero by 2050. Because I think those are two very different things. Net zero is an inevitability. It's absolutely existential. We must get there. Net zero by 2050 is a separate matter altogether. And what we've all committed to is net zero by 2050, which is where the problems are starting, not net zero more generally. And I would say, actually, on the net zero by 2050, this is topical because in December last year, in 2025, we found out that for 3 years, we've hit the 1.5 target as warming. We also found out that the whole omnibus of regulations that was going to make Europe, particularly European companies of most sizes, report on all sorts of factors, really bringing to the fore the impact of the company on the world, on the economy, has all collapsed. So this idea that investors will stick to their targets or net zero by 2050 starts to almost become moot. What difference does it make whether one particular asset owner and the other asset owner says, I can get to net zero by 2050? Because believe me, for the vast majority of my clients, I can get to net zero by 2030, let alone 2050. Because I just sell some things and I'm there. So I think we're asking the wrong question. The question is, what is the role of asset owners to take on the risks and the opportunities of an inevitable but slower than we expected and than we hoped transition to a different type of economy, which has a infinite source of energy sitting at the heart of it? And I think that we will get there. We will get there in my children's lifetime. But I think that we will have a lot of volatility on the way, and people will make money and people will lose money.
But that seems to be aligned with what Net Zero Investment Manager 2.0 is proposing.
Frankly, I don't follow it very much. And here's a capital allocator's perspective. When I go into looking at a fund manager, I do care what the fund manager as a house is saying, but I care much, much more what the mandate that I'm trying to set with the fund manager. If it's a multi-strategy fund, for instance, that's looking at different types of credit, that's what I care about. You know, what they've said about Enzami is neither here nor there and will absolutely have no bearing on any kind of sustainability mandate that I'm making. All of them signing up to things or not signing up to things is useful sometimes because it puts a lot more information in the public domain and you see flip-flops, and that in itself is an indication or, you know, certainly something to investigate. But it's a lot more nuanced than that. I really encourage your listeners to just bring a lot more nuance to these conversations.
Great. So on the asset managers, you mentioned earlier that your approach is really about allowing the investment managers to do their job, empowering them. So it's about getting the right managers in and then give them the leash to deliver on what you ask them to do. How do you find those managers?
Well, it's, you know, again, we're sort of at the foothills of this, particularly in the private markets. You know, these products are not storied. They haven't been going for 30 years. So we're at the foothills of that in the private markets, particularly in the more racy asset classes of the real assets and things like that. There are houses, of course, that have been going for a very long time that have had stellar returns. But again, particularly in the real asset side of things, whether it's real estate or private equity with operational turnarounds. I think on the public markets, it's interesting because, again, you have to think as an investment professional sometimes, not just as a sustainability professional. And what I mean is, what are the factors that often sustainability funds demonstrate? You know, factor investing. Typically, it's growth and sometimes growth and quality. I last year worked with a very large client. I'm going to keep it all very fuzzy, but they had a very, very large mandate that was all in one factor. It wasn't with the same manager, but it was with one factor, which was growth. And we realized this was getting very undiversified. And what we needed to do was bring some value in as well as a equity factor. And so, you know, we looked for value managers and picked one and took some money out of some of the others and put it into the value just so you had some diversification. Now, there was a sustainability aspect to this, but the real reason this was being done was not the sustainability aspect, which frankly, beyond the point, all the managers, including ones with very different factor thinking, were thinking on the same along the same lines. But to give you an example, a value investor will say, you know, I actually think that lots of energy firms, particularly the mid-market energy firms, are undervalued because they've been unloved, particularly pre the Russian invasion of Ukraine. They were unloved because they'd been doing badly for a long time. By the way, I think the enabling environment of that work is also unloved. Let's buy those because their value, their price to earnings ratio is cheaper. And then let's see if we can get them to transition, because that's the new business model anyway, that everyone's going to have to do over long periods of time, where often these projects are long periods of time. You could have bought those companies in 2021 when they were unloved, and by 2023, my goodness, you would be sitting on quite a healthy return because they suddenly became very loved. And now they're sort of becoming the mean reverting. They're going back to their means. And so you have to think about all of these different aspects. And sometimes I think, again, nuance. We just think, oh, which manager's doing this well? Which manager's doing this badly? It just doesn't work like that. And that's why I feel like we need to make sure that actually everyone is doing it well enough that we can go back to financial fundamentals.
Good. Look, I think we're getting close to the end. Is there anything that we haven't discussed that you would recommend the asset owner community to look at as we look into this year? And, you know, what would be the encouragement if someone is keen to do this, either from the sustainable investment perspective or from the impress perspective, that you think specifically requires attention as we look at 2026?
I just think the important thing, the only thing I would say, is that in times of market dislocation are great opportunities to enter markets. So if you've been sitting on some ideas that you quite like the look of and you want to go ahead, think about that in 2026. And on the sustainability side of things, I think be very careful that some of the decisions you've made over the last 5 years are not having unintended consequences, both from a sustainability performance perspective or from a financial performance perspective.
Great. Thank you. Now, we have a section of the pod that kind of brings up sustainability art that you might have thought of or like, and that you want to share with the community at large. Have you got one?
This is such a tricky question. We were talking about this before we talked on the podcast, and I was saying I'm a books person, so it would very much be books, but I could never choose one. So therefore, I've gone for an artist instead of a particular piece of art, and it's M.C. Escher. He's a Dutch 20th century artist, and if you see his work, you would recognize it. You know, it's all these ladders going up or down. You're not quite sure. There's a lot of illusion and thinking. I particularly like waterfall, ascending and descending. What I love about all of his work, actually, is that it forces you to look at it and look at it again and look at it again and think, what exactly is happening here? What's the picture? You are forced to think about the nuance and you see all the little things that are happening, which is all of the conversations we've been having today. That, you know, when we were thinking in PRI terms, when we were market making or trying to be standard setters at the time, that standard setters hadn't stepped up, Lorenzo, we were thinking very broad brush. Today, I realized that perhaps some of those nuances were lost. So I think Escher just brings to mind, look at everything carefully, but that there's a cohesive whole to it all. And I'm very hopeful about the future. I'm not very hopeful about the speed that we get there. 2050, etc. But I actually think on average, this century, we're going to crack this problem, but maybe even sooner than we expect.
Nice to have a positive spin. Look, another thing we do before we close is we have these quick fire questions, and they link obviously to the topic. So the first one is sustainable investing, integration or thematic?
Both.
Asset owner governance, strong, weak, or in between?
Extremely variable, often depending on size.
Double materiality, in or out?
I don't think this is me speaking. It seems to be the market speaking. I think materiality is very key, double and single. Market seems to be saying out.
Sustainable investments in 5 years' time, dead or alive and kicking?
Oh, alive and kicking, but expected to look maybe different from what you thought it would look like.
And one more. I'm just thinking of what you said earlier. 1.5 Celsius, dead or alive?
Oh, come on. I think 1.5 Celsius with no overshoot is dead.
Okay, good. Look, thanks so much. I really have enjoyed the conversation. There's so many takeaways, but if I look at my notes, I think the main thing is something around, look, if you're working with asset owners in sustainable investment today, you really need to stop homogenizing things and you need to look at the nuance of things. And this is across the why. So why are you doing it? Well, there's probably a nuance into the why. It's also the how. I loved how you also highlighted the importance of selecting a managers and then letting them be and letting them take things on. And ultimately, maybe as an example of that, maybe in terms of instead of focusing on the net zero initiatives, looking at what are the actual risks and opportunities in the market out there and looking at those on a practical perspective, and how does therefore that influence not necessarily the type of organization you work with, but the specific mandate that you're actually owning into. So I knew it from the beginning, I was going to learn a lot, and I did. So thanks so much for being on the show, Anastasia.
Thanks for having me, Lorenzo. Pleasure.
And thanks also to Curtis File and to the Earworm team for putting the production together. And if you enjoyed the episode, please like, subscribe, and comment. And we hope to see you in the next show. And until then, stay wired.